Good afternoon, and thank you all for holding. Your lines will remain on a listen-only mode for the duration of today's conference. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Shondell Dawson. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Well, welcome, everyone. This is Shondell Dawson. I'm a Senior Program Specialist with the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program here in the Administration for Children and Families in the Family and Youth Services Bureau. We are very pleased that so many of you have been interested in joining us. We had over 1,500 people registered to participate in this webinar, and what that says to us is that this topic is very important to you all and to your work, and we want to thank you for your investment in supporting children and youth as well as their parents. The Office of Head Start and the Office of Child Care and the FIPSA program are pleased to be able to welcome you to the very launch of our first webinar series. Each month for the next 4 months, we will have a webinar that will focus on the important work around supporting children exposed to domestic violence and forming partnerships with families as well as forming partnerships in the communities. This webinar is entitled Trauma-Informed Approaches to Domestic Violence Exposure, Adverse Childhood Experiences, and Resiliency. Over the next 90 minutes, Rebecca Levinson, as well as Leanna Kennicott, will be speaking with you all about the advanced thinking related to adverse childhood experiences and children's exposure to domestic violence, and emphasizing ways that we can see opportunities for primary prevention, as well as support trauma-informed parenting and prevent the intergenerational transmission of violence, trauma, and abuse where we can. This is also an opportunity to provide resources and information for child care providers, Head Start directors, early childhood workers, and families, and sort of thinking about the impact of children's exposure to violence, what resources may be available to be supportive, and how we can support working on improving the health and well-being of children and families that are served both within child care programs as well as Head Start programs across the country. We know that relationships with caring and supportive adults provide a protective resource for both parents and children who have experienced domestic violence. And we also know that as early childhood workers and early childhood specialists, that you all have a very vital role in forming relationships with families, thinking about the development of children, and also connecting families to resources. So you're in a very critical position to be able to provide support to both families and children, as well as staff who may be supporting children in your care. On behalf of the Office of Head Start and Kirsten Beigel and the Office of Child Care, as well as Carolyn Dean, I really want to thank not only our speakers for today for sharing their expertise, but to thank Mie, Leanna, Ruby, and Carrie for all of your thoughtfulness in helping us put together a very comprehensive webinar series platform. I hope that you all will think that this webinar is very helpful in connecting you all to important information and helping to improve your work in support of families. I now would like to pass the floor to Mie so that she can talk you all through the technological components of this webinar. Mie?
All right, actually, this is Carrie, and I'm going to jump in for Mie. This is Carrie Sonmore with the Battered Women's Justice Project, and I'm here to help out with the technology today. And I would just like to acknowledge that we did receive an overwhelming amount of registrations for this webinar, and we appreciate all your patience throughout the registration process and now also through the technical sound issues. Before we start, I would like to briefly go over some logistics. So if you do happen to get disconnected from the webinar at any point in time, just go back to that original email and click on the join link, and that should log you right back in. If you need help logging on, you can call iLink Support, and you can reach them at 1-800-799-4510. And let me type that into the chat box for everybody as well. And you can find this chat box at the lower left-hand corner of your screen. To use this feature, put your cursor in the bottom white rectangle, enter your text, and then hit the Enter key on your keyboard to submit your text. We have muted all the participants, so please use this feature for any comments, questions that you have. And if you do run into any technical problems, ask if you could share a private chat with me. To do so, click on that private tab, double-click on my name, which again is Carrie Sonmore, and then a box will open up for you to send me a private chat. Looks like a lot of you have already figured out how to use the public chat, but for those who haven't, it would be great if you could just let us know where you're joining us from today. If you could just type that into the public chat, that would be great. And then for those who are only on the audio portion today, if you have any questions, we can still get those over to the presenters. Please send an email over to Liana Kinnicutt, and she will make sure to bring the questions up to the webinar. And her email address is lkinnicutt@futureswithoutviolence.org. And I believe Mie also sent an email to everybody with that email address to keep that on file there. We are recording the webinar today, and this will be available in 2 business days. We will send out a follow-up email to everyone with a link to this recording. It will also include the PowerPoint slides and resources that we will be using during the presentation. And that's all that I have for today, so I'll pass it over to our presenter, Rebecca Levinson.
Well, thank you, Carrie, and thank you, Chandel. I am so excited to be joining all of you today. I'm fast-forwarding my slides, and, you know, as Chandel mentioned, you all are these recipients of something very hot off the press here at Futures Without Violence, and I should back up and introduce myself a little bit here, I guess. So I am Rebecca Levinson, and I worked as a senior policy analyst at Futures for about 13 years, and I now consult for them. And my colleague Linda Chamberlain and I have been thinking a lot about adverse childhood experiences and how we help the field see the forest through the trees. So we have, as you can see, seeing the forest through the trees, the impact of trauma beyond adverse childhood experiences is what we're really going to be talking about today. What we're going to be doing is giving you a definition of trauma. We're going to talk about the impact of adverse childhood experiences. We're going to talk about the effects of adverse childhood experiences specifically on parenting skills. And we're also going to be looking at domestic violence as well. We're going to be talking about resiliency. And we're going to be talking about concrete strategies that you can be doing with parents in your program. So before I launch, I would love to have a sense of who is on the phone, so hopefully you all can see this poll question and you can select which of the following best represents the work that you do in the field so that I have a sense as I use examples and sort of move us forward, you know, who's in the room with us, so to speak. So folks could click on which of these best describes your occupation. That would be great.
Okay, and to do so, you should be able to just click on the circle next to your choice.
It looks like maybe folks are having difficulty doing that. Are folks able to click on it? And maybe you could let us know in the public chat if you're able to see the poll and if you're able to click on it.
Yes, I can on my end, too.
Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay. I'm getting a little sense of who's on the phone. That's great. Thank you. I'll give you just a second more. Yep, I see him. And Mia, maybe you can you leave the numbers up for me? Okay.
Yeah.
So, perfect. Thank you. So I have a good sense of who's joined us on the call. So let's go on to the next slide, and it's also a poll question. And I'm wondering, of the folks on the call today, how many of you have had training on adverse childhood experiences? So this is the next question. How many of you have had training on adverse childhood experiences specifically? Okay, great. So some of you have and some of you have not. So some of you, this is new information to you. Okay, great. All right, perfect. Moving on. So who is this module for? You know, it's really for the range of providers that I see have joined us on this call. So everyone from home visitation to early childhood, domestic violence programs, child welfare programs, pediatric programs. And I guess one of the things that we're really excited about with this work is that we really are holding something we call a wellness lens. And it's about building resiliency skills and resilient programming. And our whole philosophy, I think, is about how to do this work in a trauma-informed way. So it's a shift from what is wrong and really sitting too long in what is wrong to where do we want to go? Where do we take all the information that we've learned about adversity and apply it to what concrete things make a difference in families' lives? I think a really important place to start is always with all of you, right? So here we are talking about the work that you do with families, and we recognize that many of the folks on this phone may have had their own experiences with trauma, right? So trauma is prevalent. I always assume that there are survivors of childhood abuse, survivors of domestic and sexual violence on the call with us, and we just really want to recognize that there are things that may come up in this webinar that might be triggering, and we want you to, you know, be aware and take care of yourself first. Take a break if you need to, et cetera. Because this is being recorded, you can always go back and listen to it if you need to take a break. So I love this particular image. This is a picture of hills in Marin County. It's by an artist named Cristo, and this is called The Running Fence. And it's a crazy thing because what he had to do was he had to partner with ranchers, individual homeowners, public land to run this crazy, beautiful white fence all across. It's made of fabric all across the hills of Marin County. So it's this example of partnership that's sort of beautiful. And I think this quote sort of fits with that image. So to put the world in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must first put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must first cultivate our personal life. We must first set our hearts right. So again, when we think about this work, it really begins with us as we move out into our circles and our work and community. So what is trauma? It's an experience that's overwhelming for that person. And it looks different for all of us. And you can see in the corner there's a young girl who has two other girls saying mean things about her, likely in the background. Someone else is in an emergency room. You can see a dog is biting a person. And then on the stairs you see a child who's witnessing domestic violence. Point being that this is a universal experience. So I wish we were live together in one room because I think it's powerful when we can have a chat about it. But I think it works virtually too. So what I'd like you all to do, every single person on this webinar right now, is to close your eyes. And I want you to think about a time in your life when you felt helpless. And I don't mean big helpless, I mean little helpless. Like you were in a car accident. Maybe you lost your child in the grocery store for 5 minutes and your heart was racing. Maybe your cell phone died in the middle of an incredibly important phone call and there was no charger. So just take a second and think about what was going on for you and how you were feeling inside. And chances are decent that you had a range of experience. And depending upon who you are and what your experience was, it might look a little different. So maybe you hyperventilated. Maybe you felt really hot all over. Maybe your heart was racing. Maybe you had a hard time catching your breath. Maybe all the blood went into your stomach and you felt nauseated. Maybe you felt panicky, like, I've got to get out of here. Maybe time stopped for you. So the range of experiences is, of course, different depending upon what's going on. But, you know, what I want you to do right now, because I just took you on a journey where I asked you to look at something that was difficult for yourself, a moment in time where your heart raced, I want to take a moment and acknowledge that I just asked you to do that. And I want to give you an example of the kind of thinking that we've been doing that folks should be promoting among themselves within their programs, along with the things that they're promoting with the families that they work with. So right now, sitting in your chair, what I want you to do is take a deep breath in, hold it for a count of three, and blow it out. And you can see here that this is an exercise if you're able to stand up and put your back against the wall. or rub your hands under cold water. These are all like evidence-based examples of the kinds of things that can help bring the blood back into your brain and help you sort of recalibrate after you've gone through a triggering experience. And that's really the core of what all of this work is about, is how do we build in these kinds of things for home visitors, for you know, early child head start workers, et cetera, in the field. So resilience is a shift from reactivity, right? So we talked about all of those things that you were feeling as a result of thinking about something that made you helpless, to a state of resourcefulness. And that example that I gave around, you can do the grounding exercise with your back against the wall, or you can do deep breathing, helps us in moments of crisis. I also think that it's important when we're thinking about adverse childhood experiences that we think about the bigger picture of trauma, because certainly there are more things that affect people's lives than what's necessarily on that adverse childhood experiences list. And I know some of you haven't heard the list yet, but I promise it's coming. But these are, of course, also things that affect childhood and affect parenting and adults. So community violence, bullying, poverty, oppression, all of these things affect health and well-being. So the goals for programs is that we want a trauma-informed big picture thinking in the program. So ACEs and domestic violence are just part of the big picture. We want to focus on what works and what helps, rather than spending a huge, big dig deep in looking at all bad things. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean when we get a little farther in the slide. So I think most importantly, before I launch into what is ACEs and bigger thinking about trauma, is that it's not a destiny, right? So population data will make it seem like it is, but hang on, it gets better. So what's getting lost in translation? The average childhood experience data that you're about to be exposed to is overwhelming. And I have someone breathing deep into a paper bag, because I think for folks who've never heard this work before, it's powerful, especially if you yourself have a large number of ACEs and you have never had anybody make those connections before. Individual adverse childhood experiences scores are not necessarily predictive of poor health outcomes. I think ACEs help us better understand the connection to ourselves and our health, relationships, and parenting. So it's part of the story, but it isn't the whole story, and resiliency is a really important piece of the story as well. So I just want to do a check-in, and this is a poll question. So, Mie, I think you're going to give them a different kind of box to look at. And I just want to double-check with the audience, how is the speed going for you thus far? Am I too fast? That's not the right poll question. So we're doing a little poll question, Mie, on what the pacing is like for the viewer, if that's possible. Maybe that's question four for you. Oh, okay, that was perfect. Can you show that little pie chart again, Mie, so that I can see what they're saying to us?
Yep, let me give folks a little bit of time to
answer. Oh, good.
Yeah,
perfect. So it looks like for most people, the pacing is about right. A few folks would like it slower, okay, but it looks like the bulk of folks are feeling like it's just right. So perfect, thank you. So moving on. So adverse childhood experiences, let me tell you about the study. So there was a doctor at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California. His name is Vincent Felitti. And what he wanted to look at was the issue of obesity in his patient population. And that's actually this is why the story is funny. So he was looking at the issue of obesity. He got some money from Kaiser to put together an interesting group of experts around the issue of obesity. So recognizing that, you know, patients who are morbidly obese have, you know, multiple hundreds of pounds to lose. They're more likely to have diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure and strokes and all of these other health effects. So what if we could help folks who wanted to be helped by offering them a whole menu of support? So he had a behavioral health specialist on his team. He had a nutritionist on his team. You were able to get a drug called OptiFast, which if you take it perfectly, you can lose up to 300 pounds safely in 1 year. He had exercise experts on staff, et cetera. So basically the idea was that you as a patient at Kaiser Permanente could volunteer into this group and work on weight loss if that was something that you wanted to do. And what happened is, as he was working on this study, you know, women and men started losing weight, so lost the weight, let's say 100, 150, maybe even 200 pounds, but they're short of the goal, right? They wanted to lose, let's say, 400 pounds, and they started dropping out of the program. And in particular, he saw a large number of women dropping out of the program. So he got some money to do a qualitative study to ask women why they dropped out of the program. And one day, he made a mistake as he was asking some questions of one of the women who had dropped out. Instead of asking the question, how much did you weigh the last time you had sex, right? Reasonable question. He asked, how much did you weigh the first time you had sex? And her answer was something like 47 pounds. And what Vince Felitti would say is that he and his practice had never really met any patients that had experienced incest. But he never had made the connection himself to how perhaps an adversity in childhood might be connected to long-term health consequences. And that's really how the AIDS study was born. And he started asking other questions. So in addition to asking questions about, you know, did you experience sexual abuse as a child, he asked about emotional abuse, physical abuse. He asked about physical and emotional neglect. He asked about whether your parents had been separated or divorced, substance abuse, whether your mom had experienced domestic violence, mental health, and he asked if your parent had been incarcerated. And what's important about this Kaiser Permanente study is that this was a fairly affluent group that he was working with. So the predominantly folks were white. Most of them had been college educated, and as you can see here, no one expected to see the kind of prevalence that we see. So you can see that in terms of childhood sexual abuse, 22% of the participants said that they had experienced childhood sexual abuse. 28% had experienced physical abuse. And when I'm talking about physical abuse here, I'm not talking about spanking. I'm talking about you received an injury from your parents as a result of the punishment that you received. And then you can see here the other highlighted one toward the bottom is the prevalence of intimate partner violence. So what's important to know is where there's one ACE, one adverse childhood experience, it's a lot likely that there'll be another. So what are the effects of ACEs on adult health? And for those of you who have had training before, I'm going to let you type in the chat box, and Yay is going to help me bring up this poll question and let you all just sort of type in. Actually, Mia, I think I'm going to skip this one just because it can take a while, and I'll just go ahead and jump in to what kinds of things we've seen related to ACEs. So we know that it's connected to obesity, heart disease, cancer, lung disease, liver diseases, right? No surprise, it's connected to mental health outcomes, drug and alcohol abuse. And in terms of the bigger thinking about domestic violence, I think it's important to note that there's a 95% probability that a child growing up with domestic violence will be exposed to at least one other ACE, and that more than a third of children exposed to domestic violence have had four or more ACEs. Now I want to show you the flip of this thinking. So adverse childhood experiences are risk factors for domestic violence in adults, right? So among persons who had had three forms of violent childhood experiences, so they had experienced childhood sexual abuse, physical abuse, and they witnessed domestic violence, the chances that a woman would be at risk for victimization was increased 3.5 times, and the risk of perpetration among men was increased by 3.8. So you can see that these things, right, are connected. And what's important about this bigger picture, and Future has really, you know, thought long and hard about this, because historically we've been very focused on childhood exposure to domestic violence. And what we've realized is that, you know, the silo approach doesn't allow us to look at the big picture. And here's some nice examples of some silos. So why talk about ACEs in the context of domestic violence? Because we're looking to create a trauma-informed framework for childhood adversities that allow us to look at this bigger picture. So that's the truth of our families, right? DV is part of ACEs. It doesn't sit alone in the box. And we really believe ACEs thinking must be integrated into domestic violence programming and practice and vice versa. So why does this matter? So for those of you who are doing work with children on this phone, and I think it's the bulk of you, you know, you all know that trauma and attachment with a parent are linked. And that exposure to trauma and the process of learning to trust caregivers while strong attachment relationships that can blunt, that trauma disrupts the process of learning to trust caregivers. And so what we want to do is invest in relationships between moms and children. We know that moms' past and recent traumatic experiences increase the risk of a whole host of parenting problems, including child neglect, history of child protective services, physical punishment. But we also know that social support and taking care of one's own needs, so for the mom, taking care of her own needs, are protective factors that reduce the likelihood of these outcomes, and that's what we're striving for in our program. So why focus on strengths and resiliency? And, you know, again, if we were live, I could say, so why are you doing this in your programs? And you all would come up with a whole host of reasons. But I think what we'd ultimately come up with as a group is that protective factors have a stronger influence on children who grow up with adversity than specific factors or stressful life events do. Meaning, if we can focus on these strengths and build up programming that addresses these pieces that support resiliency, we can make a huge difference in the lives of children. And what's important to note, too, is that the protective factors remain consistent across different ethnic, social, geographical, and historical boundaries. So resilience, what are we talking about? Well, I think it's important to note that not all children are equally affected by adverse childhood experiences, exposures. And that's part of what we're going to be holding. I'm going to hold this space as we talk about how domestic violence and ACEs affects kids. We know that the impact of childhood exposure to domestic violence and ACEs can have a huge impact on brain development. It can be associated with physical changes in the brain, altered brain chemistry. It can lead to problems that interfere with the child's ability to self-regulate, focus, and learn. And those three pieces, the self-regulation, the focus, and the learning, is so, so important to a child's growth and development and how they manage for the rest of their lives. So this idea that we're going to focus on those three pieces is, I think, exciting in the context of the work that we're doing on ACEs. No surprise, too, kids who have been exposed to adverse childhood experiences, domestic violence, other community violence traumas, they experience difficulty in school. They're more likely to have developmental delays, and they're more likely to have behavioral problems. In terms of additional symptoms, and this is some work from Nadine Burke-Harris, right, we can see everything from sleep disturbances to hair loss, aggression, failure to thrive. These are kids that numb out. They have poor impulse control. They have increased issues with asthma. The list goes on. Very similar to what we're seeing in adults. So it's both this combination of physical ailments as well as emotional and social issues. And then as we see these children who've grown up in these homes, we see higher rates of bullying, dating violence, early onset of sexual activity, early onset of drug and alcohol abuse, more likely to carry weapons to school, and we see teen pregnancy as an issue as well, both for boys and for girls becoming teen parents. So I do want to take a second. So, Mie, this is going to be a poll question as soon as I'm done talking about the slide. So I want everyone on the webinar to consider this for a second. So which child is most affected? All are living in a home with domestic violence. So I'm going to ask you for a show of hands. Alex has one ACE. Alex has one adverse childhood experiences. So he's got only domestic violence in his home. Michaela has two ACEs. Francisco has three ACEs. And Asuko has eight ACEs. We know that one ACE for each of these children is witnessing or living in a home where their mother's experiencing domestic violence. So excuse me, Mie, if you could pull up a poll for me, please. That looks at the perfect. So if everyone could just take a moment and click and tell me what their best guess is. Which child is most affected, Alex, Michaela, Francisco, or Suso? And Nia, whenever you can let me see what people are clicking, that would be helpful. Thank you. So, okay, let me give you one more second here. So you can see that 37, oh, can I have that back, Nia? Can you show me the numbers again, please? Cool, okay. So you can see about 35 of you thought Alex with one ace was having the hardest time. Michaela with two aces, some of you thought that. Francisco with three. But overwhelmingly, Asuka with eight aces is what everybody, the child that everyone assumes is having the most difficult time. So what I want to tell you is that this is based on real children. And in fact, Alex is the one that is having the most difficult time. Alex's mother is in a horrifically abusive relationship. She has been in the hospital as a result of her injury. She is numbed out. She is unable to function, basically, as a mother to Alex. Michaela and Francisco and Asuko all have a huge number of supports. Their mothers are very supportive. The violence is not as great in their homes. They have outside services, et cetera, et cetera. The reason we're talking about this is because what's tricky with ACEs is it's pretty easy to get caught up, again, in that population-based data, right? So when I share those numbers with you, that you're four times more likely to have this problem or that problem, or much more likely to perpetrate domestic violence or be a survivor of domestic violence when you grow up, we're looking at big population data. We're not looking at individual people when we talk about this. And I think that's one of the things that the field really needs to sort of sit with, because it helps us not make the mistake of assuming things that we don't know about the kids that we're working with. And I'm going to – oh, there we go. Okay. And so this is a slide that actually shows us that – in fact, poverty in and of itself, we see as a risk factor for having more ACEs. So that's a piece that is important for folks to know. And I'm going to move my slide. Mia? Oh.
Sorry, I'm going to upload the second part.
Okay. Oh, perfect. So in addition to sort of considering poverty, and this is why it's so important, because poverty wasn't one of the things that was considered in the initial adverse childhood experiences study, the adversities from the original ACE scale items were associated with mental health symptoms among participants, but the association was significantly improved by removing some of the original ACE scale items and was adding others, like peer rejection, peer victimization, exposure to community violence, school performance and socioeconomic status, meaning that we recognize that divorce may not be something that's particularly traumatic to children, especially if they've been growing up in single-family homes and perhaps others in their families are coming from single-family homes. But these other pieces, community violence being a big one, matters a lot, right? So if you're a child who's 5 years old and you've seen 17 dead bodies, as a colleague of ours shared last week, who's been doing work around communities that are truly suffering with massive amounts of violence. You've seen 17 deaths. You've seen gunshots. You have had people in your own family that have been murdered. That's a huge issue, right? So the number piece, I think, again, needs to be really thoughtfully considered as we kind of think about this measurement. And we'll talk a little bit more about why teachers is kind of going in the direction that we're going in. So I do have two more poll questions for you. Will clients answer questions about adverse childhood experiences with you truthfully? Yes, no, or you're unsure. So go ahead and click on these. Do you think your clients will answer questions about adverse childhood experiences truthfully? And I'll give you a second to go through those. And Nia, whenever you can show me a number of you say yes, some of you say no. And the question is, if you answered no, tell me why. If the question is no, tell me why. They may be afraid. You're a stranger. Fearful of being reported. Embarrassed. Okay. Perfect. So thank you for your issues of trust. Perfect. Okay, let's look at the second question then. Can you imagine a situation where a parent, A4, thank you, Mie. So this is another poll question for you. Can you imagine a situation where a parent, A4, may be used against them? Yes, no, or unsure. But can you imagine a situation where a parent's A4 would be used against them? And if your answer is yes, tell me why. Or how. CPS, custody issues, custody CPS. And Mia, can you show me, so 198 of you, I'd love for all of you to weigh in if you could, because this is a really important question, I think, for us as a field to really hear from you all about. And I see over and over again, stigma, fears of CPS, fears of child welfare, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you for answering that question for me. And we're going to go to the next question. Next slide. That's me, not me, sorry. You know, I think what you're hitting on is something that we've learned specifically in domestic violence. So these are some this is from a qualitative study done about home visitation and domestic violence. And you can see here's the quote at the top. If mandatory reporting was not an issue, she would tell the nurse everything about the abuse. And you can see there's two quotes here. I say no when my home visitor asks about abuse because that's how you play the game, because people are afraid of social services. That's my biggest fear. And like I was saying about my friend, the reason she don't disclose is because she thinks the nurse is going to call children's services. She avoids the nurse a lot. And I guess that's one of the pieces that we've heard from the field is that this issue of fear around child welfare reporting associated with ACEs is complicated and it's real. I also think that this is important, and we, you know, Lynn and I had the opportunity to go up to Washington State and to learn from advocates about what's happening on the ground, and here's what one of the advocates shared with us. When I think about ACEs and domestic violence, I think about 101 ways. I just learned I messed up my kid today. In my community, ACE awareness has created huge stigma for mothers who are currently surviving domestic violence. And what I want to say in response to that is that we know that some mothers who face severe stress and within the context of their violent relationship, they compensate for those events by offering increased nurturing and protection of their children. And we also know that children's emotional recovery from exposure to domestic violence depends more on the quality of their relationship with a non-abusive parent than any single factor. So when we talk about recognizing that ACEs, in fact, can be creating these conversations in your community that may be saying, you know, my goodness, we know that exposure to ACEs, exposure to domestic violence can really impact kids. We need to balance that with this kind of conversation. And there's a huge amount of fear, I think, associated around child welfare with both of these issues, ACEs and domestic violence. So I want to shift because I want to talk about resilience, and this is where it gets exciting. So resilience is the capacity to rise above difficult circumstances, and this is the stuff that we want to arm our mothers with, our fathers with, our programs with, and we want to help children to exist in a less than perfect world while living and moving forward with optimism and confidence. And if you don't know Kenneth Ginsberg's work on fostering resilience, you can see there's a little link here. His work is fabulous, and you can Google search him by name or fostering resilience, all one word, to find out more. So we know that the impact of trauma is affected by multiple factors, including what was that kid like when they were born? What's their temperament? What is their gender? We know that the characteristics of the family and community matter. And frankly, part of that community is all of you who are doing work with young children. and with families. We also know that the characteristics of the trauma, the frequency, severity, and proximity matter. So I mentioned that Alex is the child with 1A that is having the most difficult time compared to his other children who have more adverse childhood experiences. Here's another tool for you. If you don't know about Future's work on promising futures, you can go to our website and take a look. You can see here that there are tools and conversations that are happening around the individual, the family, and the communities, and strategies there. So if you don't know about that tool, I wanted you to. And now I want to talk a little bit about Luke's story. So Luke is a little boy whose story was written up in the New York Times. I believe it was in May 2014. And we can send you a link to it if you're interested. But, you know, Luke, like a lot of the children in your program, came from a hard situation. You know, there was a great deal of neglect. There was a lot of substance abuse on the part of both parents. I believe his father was incarcerated. I think his mother lost custody of him, and he was being raised by his grandparents. And Luke was acting out and angry and pretty out of control in preschool and in school. And, you know, what do you do with the Lukes of the world? And I know that you all work with these beautiful children who have so much trauma, and it's about figuring out how we can support both the Lukes and their parents or caregivers around this issue of self-regulation, right? So remember, self-regulation is that ability to manage emotions, energy states, behavior and attention. And I like this little orange box to the side, right? The number one survival skill is the power to be able to regulate your thoughts. You know, where there's too much trauma or stress for too long, we can develop that hair trigger response, like a leaf falling on the car hood, and it sets off an alarm. And think about that for Luke. So what did we do? What did they do with Luke in the preschool program that he was a part of? Well, he has a special bracelet that he wears that's always there, and that's a talisman for him. It's a reminder for him to breathe and to take 3 or 4 deep breaths. He learns that he can give himself a hug. And literally, it's that the example I gave earlier was you put your back up against the wall, you breathe. Another trick is you crisscross your arms and you touch your tongue to the roof of your mouth. These are all self-regulation techniques. If those things don't work, he goes to a cozy corner. And in that cozy corner is a special box. And in that special box is textured things, right? So maybe it's velvet that makes him feel calmer. Maybe it's roughness. Maybe it's burlap. Maybe it's polished stones. He learns that he can find help from an adult. And this has been used across all kinds of places, kids and programs, and it's been shown to make a big difference. If you ever wanted to learn how to breathe, I can think of no two better people on the planet. This is the artist Common. And, of course, this is Elmo. And what Sesame Street decided to do was take on how do we, in a fun, supportive way, teach parents, kids, and caregivers to breathe. And so this is something that was sent to you all in the packet that you got, the electronic packet that you got from Mie and Liana for this webinar. Bracelets, they say breathe. So one of the things, if I were to come to your state and do this training, you know, everybody gets a breathing bracelet. And the idea here is that we're going to create a common language. We're going to talk about trauma as something that happens to our whole community so that the counselor or the teacher wears a breathe bracelet, the child wears a breathe bracelet, the mother wears a breathe bracelet. The idea being that we all benefit, right, from this focus on social-emotional regulation. And it's not about us and them, right, but it's about all of us. So ACE scores, from a research perspective, have been invaluable to the field. It was a game changer. We learned so much about how adversity can affect health and well-being moving forward in people's lives, and that it gives us an opportunity to help educate patients and parents about how it's affected them so that they can ideally make changes and find support and not feel so alone. But in practice, as we indicated with poverty data or the story that I told about Alex, we need to rethink the direction we go with this work. If we focus on high-scoring folks, high-scoring parents, high-scoring kids, we might be missing a portion of the population that's deeply affected by ACEs and trauma, like Alex. So disclosure is not the goal when it comes to ACEs. I think universal education with parents about trauma is the goal, right? So universal education assumes that everyone has trauma and triggers and will benefit from knowledge, tools, and support. And it shifts staff concerns away from worrying about seeming judgmental. And that was one of the things that came up in the chat box. Like, why wouldn't someone want to talk with you about ACEs? Well, it's because I don't feel safe, right? I don't feel like I can trust them. I don't know what they're going to do with that information. So if we are presenting ACEs in this universal framework as opposed to what is your ACE for, I think that can change the game a little bit. I think it empowers staff and their clients to understand the connections to self, health, well-being, and parenting, and what they can do next to help themselves and their kids. And I think that, you know, part of what's so complicated about sitting with ACEs is, okay, now what? What do we do? And so this is really, again, more about what we can do. And I would say that this is also, you know, program-centric, meaning, you know, Futures has worked with home visitation and early Head Start and, you know, caseworkers and, you know, program-serving parents and kids for a very long time, and we've listened. And one of the things that we hear over and over again is that, gosh, I don't have a lot of time to talk about various other things with the folks I serve. So what's the best use of your limited time when it comes to ACEs is part of what we're asking. So having parents score the ACE tool and explain that no matter what their number is, it isn't a destiny, because that's what you'd have to do. So for example, I will tell you all that my ACE score is 8. My joke is I would have been way better off if my ACE score was 9, because that would have meant my mother divorced my father while I was a child. That would have been awesome. But that's not how it went down, right? So if I were the parent that one of you were talking to, and I'm a mother of 4 children, if I was the parent who got my ACE score of 8, you'd have to tell me that, Rebecca, that doesn't mean you're going to be a bad mom. That doesn't mean that you're going to have 50 or more sexual partners, because that's one of the things, if you look at the population-based data, that it says. Doesn't mean that you're going to be a drug addict. Doesn't mean all these other bad things that we know are connected are going to be happening to you. So is it better to talk somebody down off a ledge, or is it better to spend your time on what works after doing universal education about, yeah, making a connection? We want moms and dads to understand how ACEs can affect them so that we can hopefully support them in doing a better job taking care of themselves and for their kids. So what is the most trauma-informed way to talk about connections? And I want to go back to this concept of trauma for just a minute. You know, do you think being asked or reading questions about adverse childhood experiences might be upsetting for parents? You know, I would say that a number of you guessed the answer was yes. And what happens when you're upset? And we were just talking about this in terms of self-regulation with kids. Can you hear when you're upset? It's like, okay, so if this is the first time anybody's made the connection and you've just had to answer or read through a series of questions that says, when you were 18 years of age or younger, you know, were you forced to do sexual things you didn't want to do? Did anyone force you to do sexual things to them that you did not want to do? Were you ever injured as a result of punishment, et cetera, et cetera? You can imagine that reading those questions are probably going to increase your heart rate. You know, and I'm not saying that these are devastating things for parents. I think it can be powerful to understand these connections. But if what we're trying to do is teach self-regulation and do that in a brief encounter, maybe what we want to do, again, is more of this universal education rather than necessarily doing sort of the screen or using those tools for the screen. And I guess the other question is, can you learn as well when you're triggered? So I think that part of what the field is grappling with is, what's the difference between you as an adult, with your adult primary caregiver, talking about these things versus you in the parent role talking about your own exposures and your children's exposures with other staff, with other programs outside of your adult primary caregiver. I think it looks quite different. So David Finkelhor in 2013, who's the father of looking at all child maltreatment in the U.S. He's been doing it for a very long time. He's published really important stories, articles demonstrating the prevalence of children exposed to violence, children who experience physical and sexual violence. And in terms of looking at childhood adversity, he says, we know enough to move from intervention, to move to intervention and prevention, and that's really what we're doing here. So one more quick poll. I'm just wondering if my pace is still okay for all of you on the call. And Mie, if you wouldn't mind bringing up that poll question, thank you. And I can't see what folks are saying, so if you wouldn't mind sharing, Mie, what might the poll look like. So most of you think it's just right. Great. So we'll move on then. So hopefully you all received the email with the tools and you were able to look at this little safety card connected, or education card, connected parents, connected kids. If you didn't get a chance to print it out, I want to tell you that it's about the size of a business card. And as you can see, it's a picture of feet. You see child's feet in the center and adult feet on the either side. You're not totally sure if it's dad's feet or mom's feet. That was intentional. And I think it's a happy image. It's a happy image intentionally. We tested it. It's because we wanted you as caregivers in the field to feel positive about the messages that you were giving around these complex issues of adverse childhood experiences and trauma. So when you open up the card, the very first panel that you see is this one, and it says, you are a good parent. And when we think about folks who are living in chaotic communities, when we think about folks who are living in homes with domestic violence, these are words that they may not get to hear very often, and it's so important that we reinforce those words with parents. It may be hard for you to read, so I'll read it to you. As a caregiver of children, you want the best for your kids. For kids to get the best from you, it helps to be in a good place yourself, to have tools and ideas to support your well-being, and to have a backup plan for bad days. Now, this is true for all parents, right? All of us. No matter what our ACE score is or isn't, whatever trauma we've had, this is a good plan for parents, period, right? And, again, it changes the conversation from us and them to all of us. Right, healthcare providers are discovering strategies and tools that support caregivers and kids. I know that there are lots of cool young people on this call who probably know more about smartphones and QR codes, and that's what you're looking at, that little funny box. Is if you have a smartphone and you scan it on the card, it actually takes you to a video, and I'll be talking about that. So it's a place where we can reinforce that you're a good parent and reinforce some of these messages without necessarily taking up the time of the home visitor or the early child care worker or the social worker or whomever else is working with the family, that this is supposed to be a tool to help you have these conversations. So difficult childhoods, right? Many adults, about 1 in 4, grew up in homes where there was abuse or other problems. Maybe someone was hurting them. Maybe they saw a parent or caregiver being hurt. Maybe someone at home was abusing drugs or alcohol. You know, we again, really worked with the field to come up with this language, and the maybe conversation, because it's got to work both for you all as providers as it does with the clients, that maybe language made a big difference for home visitors and other workers having this conversation with parents. Hope is good, right? We want more hope. And this little panel of the card talks about what does it mean to be strong and resilient and come back from bad things. What can we do, right? So knowing how to navigate stress, being able to step back from your emotions when things get hard, et cetera. And then we do talk about the health effects, right? So difficult childhood experiences can put you and your children at higher risk for, because, you know, what we're doing is we're talking about intergenerational education and intergenerational interruption of all bad things, right? So you can imagine that the parents that you're working with have never had anyone who understood ACEs, helped them make connections to how adversities and trauma can affect their health and well-being. This might be the first time it's ever happened. And it's important that they know it for themselves, but also for their children, right? So Difficult childhood experiences can put you and your children at higher risk for repeating the cycle of violence even if you're not aware of it. It can set you up for asthma, chronic pain, obesity, smoking, drinking, prescription drug abuse, anxiety, depression, suicide, adult relationships where you're being hurt or you're hurting your partner. But this is the other really important part. That's not the end of the story. And the good news is you can find your strength, work on your health, and turn things around. For some more information, they can go to this website called ACEs Too High. That is, I want to say it's been around for almost 10 years and is a really repository of things related to adverse childhood experiences. On the back of this card, there is a little, again, QR code that talks about how to breathe. It gives you a breathing app tree for smartphones. It talks to you about the Child Helpline. So if you all aren't using this in your program, they're great. We vetted them a number of times over that this is a great support for parents that they aren't necessarily aware of, that's non-judgmental and available 24/7. And then for parents who say, whoa, I have been struggling with substance abuse, I've been struggling with depression, anxiety, some of the things that we make the connection with on the card, you know, this is a great treatment referral number that can get them to programs within their state or in their county. So what do? To hand out the card, we normalize it. I've started giving these connected parent-kids cards to all the parents in our program, everyone in our program. We give this to everyone because all parents deserve support, and we give you extra cards, too, to help friends or family members so they have support, too. One thing I want to say about this is this piece around recognizing the power of parents to be leaders around making a difference in the lives of children and the lives of their friends is such an important part of this intervention, because you can imagine if you're a super marginalized person and doesn't have a sense of power in the world, or you're in a violent relationship and you don't have a sense of power, the idea that as a caregiver in their lives, you can say, hey, you're someone who can make a difference, you just built them up just by that one simple action. And we have a paper that's coming out this year that absolutely underscores this. I can't tell you enough about like how cool that particular strategy is. So you open up the card, you do a quick review, you make warm referrals, the Child Health Hotline is anonymous. For parents, you can call if you're feeling overwhelmed and you want to talk. I've called them myself to see what it was like, and it was wonderful to speak with someone so caring and helpful. If you've never called that Child Help line, all of you on this call, I would ask that you do a little bit of homework and make a call yourself and tell them, hi, I'm calling from my program, and I want to know if I told one of my parents to call this number, what would it be like for them? Because I do think when you can normalize it and make it a warm referral, parents are more likely to engage in it. So some states may already require using the ACE 10-question tool, and there's other modifications of the tool where there's additional questions added in, but your state may already have some kind of requirement there. If this is the case, it doesn't prevent you from providing universal education. Remember, everyone benefits from normalizing the issue, understanding the connection between ACEs, health, and parenting, and learning self-regulation techniques, whether they disclose or not. And I think that's the other important thing. Remember, in our poll question earlier, you said a lot of your parents might not feel comfortable sharing what's really going on in their lives or what has happened historically in their lives. So it's obviously important to have these conversations, whether folks are sharing that kind of information with you or not. So this is about planting seeds. Many parents may not recognize how early trauma can affect their parenting and how they react to stressful situations. This is new for them. For someone to say, you know what, to get out in front and sort of talk about those pieces is so powerful and empowering to parents, I think. Increasing parents' awareness about the effects of trauma and ACEs can help them understand their own lives better and make healthier choices and ideally prevent intergenerational trauma. Here's a great example of a game that parents can do with their children. And these are obviously children who are verbal, but the idea is you can play these with Hershey's Kisses. And so, you know, mom or dad can say, you know, you're playing tic-tac-toe, and so when you choose the spot, whether it's the one in the middle or one to the right or the left, you can use that as a time to talk about when you felt loved. what was the story around that when you felt guilty? What's the story around that? How did you feel? What made you feel better? You know, just as a way to sort of talk about feelings that I think can be difficult for children to talk about. And I think it's, again, a great example for an adult to have a tool that is for their child, but it actually might help them engage in thinking about these things for themselves, because nobody ever stops to take the time to do that. So I mentioned I have four children. I am going to tell you that I hate the beginning of the day. I don't know about the rest of you, but the beginning of the day at our house is you got to do breakfast, you got to do – apparently they want you to wear clothes to school every day. I don't understand. They want – you know, you have to get shoes on, you have to find that homework, you have to find the backpack, you have to find the permission slip. So there's so many things going on, right? So typically there's like, we're trying to get all these things together. So this is an example of a mindful practice that folks can do with their children every day. So you get out the door finally, right? And maybe there was some yelling. Maybe there was some, you know, pressure to do this faster. It's a rush time of day. So if we can take time to take deep breaths together as we're getting into our car, into the bus, on the subway, or we're walking to school, where we practice relaxing parts of our bodies together, I mean, again, it helps both moms and kids. And we do the same thing at bedtime. Children love rituals, right? So if we put a stuffed animal on that child's belly and we have them move it up and down as they breathe, we end the day in a very centered and sweet way. If we were all together, you would be laughing hysterically right now, I promise, because when we come out and do training, we do bring bubbles and we bring straws. And you break into teams of 3 to 5, and your job is to blow up the bubbles, and someone's a timekeeper, and whoever, whichever group can keep that bubble up in the air and alive the longest wins a prize. Great tool to teach parents and kids to do together. Funny, fun, silly, great thing to do with your students if you're working in early child care. They will laugh. And again, it's teaching them these important tools around breathing as the self-regulatory practice that really makes a difference. Here are some other games to promote attachment and self-regulation. And I believe you've got a PDF on these various games, so I'm not going to go into detail now. I do want to mention that QR code that I talked about goes directly to this video, and hopefully some of you had a chance to watch it before our talk today. It's called Connected Parents, Connected Kids. You can Google it on YouTube, Connected Parents, Connected Kids, one word, and watch the video. And I think the reason it's so wonderful is it meets parents where they are. So our goal was really to destigmatize ACEs and the prevalence of trauma. And we wanted to also normalize using resources. So that kind of warm referral framework for all of the stuff that we do here at Teachers is such an important part of getting buy-in on the part of the parents and helping them feel safe. And we really think this is a primary prevention tool around child abuse. And it's important because we know from our work with parents that it makes them feel supported and they don't see it as punitive or judgmental. So what our talk today was about is, yes, it was about adversity. It was about adversity. But ideally, we end with this framework of resiliency and hope, right? So we know resiliency buffers the effects of trauma. So when we're thinking about ACEs and thinking about trauma, and talking to families about this, we have to have these other pieces in place around the things that make a difference for children and mothers and fathers and caregivers. Social support and resources build resiliency across the lifespan. So I know that there are a number of K-12 folks on this phone, and I know some of your programs are engaging in this. You know, I know that there's a number of national programs, one's called Toolbox, that really helps with social-emotional learning. These would be the recommendations that we would suggest to you around really supporting children. And we know trauma-informed care can increase the effectiveness of health services, early education, and case management services. So trauma and ACEs. So helping parents and caregivers understand how ACEs and trauma affect health, relationships, and parenting matters greatly when it comes to ending intergenerational violence. And I guess I have a final little question for you all. Do you think universal education using the Connected Kids Card are things that you would like to share with parents and caregivers in your program? So let me know what your thoughts are on this. So, Mia, if you wouldn't mind putting up a poll. I think you have a poll question for this. So yes, no, and unsure. And folks are going to have a chance to click on this. Do you think the universal education approach using Connected Kids Card are things that you would like to share with parents and caregivers in your program? And I can't. So, perfect. We'll keep going. I'd love to hear from more folks. Okay. All right, so we're good, Mia. I'm going to come off of this poll, so thank you for that. And I have one more slide, I think. So this is where I want to end my talk today. I love this quote. Our friend Erin Fairchild in Portland is the one that I borrowed this from because it was on her email, and it really stuck with me. And I hope it will be something that sticks with you too. What we say and what we do ultimately comes back to us. So let us own our responsibility, place it in our own hands, and carry it with dignity and strength. And I think that this is our opportunity as folks in the field forging this new path around how we hold all of these pieces together and make a real difference in the lives of our families and children. I just want to thank you all so much for joining us. And we're going to have an opportunity to answer some questions. And I know we may not get to all of them, but I promise we will try to get to all of them in writing if we don't have a chance to do it verbally in the next 25 minutes. So with that, I will turn it over to Liana because I believe she has some questions that have come in. Oh dear, she's a big piece of paper she's got right there. So please, Liana.
Well, sure. Well, first I just want to say thank you to Rebecca. That was an unbelievable amount of knowledge and expertise and very well presented. So thank you very much for that. I was watching the chat and everyone kept saying, this is great, I'm a Head Start teacher, this is wonderful, saying that the materials were applicable across a lot of the audiences on the webinar today. So with the thanks in mind, we have a few questions, and I apologize ahead of time if we don't get to everyone. But one that came in early on that I thought maybe you could just say a little bit more about. It's sort of a two-parter. You know, when you say ACEs aren't a destiny, you say a little bit more, and how do we sort of think about reversing the impact or thinking about building resiliency when trauma has occurred?
So it's a great question. So ACEs isn't a destiny. So I use my own story. So I was a child who grew up in an incredibly abusive home. I was sexually and physically abused by my father. I witnessed my mother being abused, my father was incarcerated because of the abuse of my mother. He had a massive substance abuse problem, mental health problem. Needless to say, my ACE score and my life score is very much reflective of the conversation that we're having. So when I say it isn't a destiny, I'm saying to all of you that I'm on this webinar, and I am in a very happy and healthy relationship. I'm not sure that my children would always, especially my teenagers, would always have nice things to say about me, but I can tell you that none of the abuse that I experienced in childhood was ever repeated ever in my home. And that, in fact, I don't have a whole host of health issues. So when I talk about it's not a destiny, what I mean for the individual, and I can tell you all the reasons why that was, I had good things happen in my life in spite of the bad things, and those things made a difference. And I think some of it truly is how I'm wired, too. So going back to the examples I gave about, you know, kids are going to handle it differently. Like for any of you who have children who are on this call and you have multiple children, right, you parented the same way and you got two very different little people in front of you. And so I guess that's the best way to answer it, that but the problem when you look at population-based data, right, so we're able to say as a population, so when they were looking at 17,000 people at Kaiser Permanente and their ACE scores, they were clumping them together. They were looking at you know, chart data that said, yeah, you're more likely, you're four times more likely to have suicidal ideation if you had, you know, four or more ACEs. But if I were to say, what's the difference between Rebecca and Liana sitting here at this table, and I don't know what Liana's ACE score is or if she even has one, but we are individuals that are not part of that great big population necessarily that they're looking at. We are, there's always exceptions to the rule, I guess, and that's sort of part of the point that we're trying to make. I hope, Liana, do you think that answered it?
Yes, absolutely.
And then there was a second part to that question that I got lost. So.
Well, I kind of merged the two into one, so that's good.
Okay.
Are there other things that we can encourage our families that we work with, or our mothers and children, to do to promote resiliency? We talked a little bit about breathing and some activities like the bubble. Are there other just really everyday things that we can do?
There are. And, you know, I didn't get to show you all the panels of the card because I had so much I wanted to say and it wasn't enough time. But one of the panels of the card talks about a simple measurement for success. Like, you know, we all have bad days as parents. So let's say mom yelled at child that day, or it's a really tough morning, lots of tears, hard morning. So how at the end of the day do we measure success? And it talks about specifically reading to your child, singing to your child, laughing with your child. I mean, and these are, this is not rocket science, but it, in fact, these are the things that really matter. Eating with your child, holding your child, cuddling your child, all of those things, right? So when you're having a hard, when mom's having a hard time, right, her getting a hold of herself, you saw that great image of Luke or the little boy in the pictures giving himself a big hug. What if after a hard moment with kids, we just did that with the child and with the mom? Because the mom needs that hug as much as the child does. And I think when we can talk a little bit about empathy in this systematic and organizational way, and how we model this as the caregivers, as the teachers, as the counselors, in what we do, okay, I'm not saying randomly run up and hug every parent you see because that may not be appropriate, but I am saying that we have an opportunity to teach this through the eyes of loving a child and say at the same time, and I actually do this for me too, right? This makes a difference for me too as a teacher. You know, I'm having a bad moment, I hug myself too. It's like, oh, that made me really sad in class, right? So when Johnny hit Sally, that made me really sad in class, and I feel like I kind of just need to give myself a little hug right now to make it better. And so these are examples of how we can do sort of that more profound integration that we're really tapping on here.
Definitely. Thank you. So do you have, there was a question that came in around strategies for helping kids and moms when you find out there's active domestic violence happening.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any thoughts on that?
So I want to say that my fabulous partner over here, Liana Kinnicutt and Lana Davis, have just come out with, I mean, these are literally so hot off the press, I'm not sure they're on the website, tools that are about helping moms who are in actively violent relationships support their children. And I'm going to not answer this question because I think Liana probably knows more about what's going on in those particular tools. And again, these literally, I saw them for the first time last week and it was just a glance. So,
Well, I would say first of all, if that information does come to light, normalizing it and doing some supportive counseling in the moment is always the best, is always a recommended strategy. In addition to reaching out to hopefully your community partners, domestic violence programs, calling the hotline with the mom, calling together, doing some basic safety planning. And our Futures Without Violence website, in addition to the Promising Futures website, has a number of resources that can help you through that process. But I would highly recommend reaching out to a local advocate to get some general information and help. Obviously, when you're working with children, there are concerns around safety and for the children as well as the mom. So, certainly, making some phone calls and reaching out to your colleagues for help as well. But yes, so we will send some of those direct links for the resources that are hot off the presses out. In addition to, I know there's been some questions about some people didn't receive some of the links or the PDFs ahead of time, and I apologize. And we will send out all of the tools that were mentioned on the webinar, in addition to the videos, some of these safety tools that I just mentioned, in addition to the PowerPoint slides after the webinar. And folks had also asked if it was okay to share the PowerPoint slides. And I'm thinking that that's a yes, as long, you know, we have it in a PDF. And then if anyone would like additional, there were some items in the chat about wanting more presentations from Rebecca. And I think if you want more information or presentations about this subject matter, we have a variety of sort of workshops, different lengths, different mm-hmm. types of training tools that some that you can do online, some that you would do in person. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you to reach out to my colleague, either Mie or myself, and we can sort of point you in the right direction. Rebecca, go ahead.
One thing I want to mention related to this is that we do have a, this is sort of born out of a big second edition that Futures just did around a home visitation curriculum called Healthy Moms, Happy Babies, and we just came out with a second edition. And with that second edition, we decided to sort of do away with the modules on kids exposed to violence and mothering after violence and all these things and really place it here in adverse childhood experiences. And so one of the things I want to say to you is that while Healthy Moms, Happy Babies was developed with the home visitation in mind, it's applicable to so many other programs. So in terms of how do we have some of these conversations with moms? How do we do universal education around healthy and safe relationships? We have a whole, you know, module. We didn't even touch on that today, but I wanted to mention that as another resource. And I'll have Liana also forward that one out to you all as well, because I think it's super valuable in terms of how do you have that kind of specific conversation.
Mm-hmm. Two other questions that came in. One was around different languages for the cards. And I know that, unfortunately, right now, the connected parents, the one that we showed on the webinar, is not available in Spanish, but we are currently working on it. So it should be available in the next couple of months.
Great.
But if you go to the Futures Without Violence website, under Order Our Materials, there are a number of materials that you can download for free, as well as order hard copies for free. And if any of you have trouble doing those orders, I know our website can make you jump through a few hoops to get there. Please email me directly, and I will help you get through the process. I know that there was another question about accessing local resources in terms of language access. And again, I would encourage you to call either your state coalition on domestic violence and sexual assault or the National Domestic Violence Hotline. They have access to multiple language services that can provide advocates across a variety of languages and help you find services in your local community or hopefully nearby.
The other resource that I wanted to mention is that, you know, we touched very briefly on staff's own exposure to trauma. And in the Healthy Moms, Happy Babies curriculum, the first hour and a half is dedicated to looking at that issue and how do we build trauma-informed programs. And when I say that, I mean K through 12. I mean early childhood. I mean home vis. I mean domestic violence agencies. I mean everybody. That this has got to be the way we build the plane, because we know too much not to build the plane that way at this point. And again, this idea that we're expecting staff or teachers or early childhood caregivers or counselors to be doing this work and not acknowledging the prevalence of these issues in their own lives is just wrong. So I very much encourage you, for those of you who are in leadership positions or in a position to advocate with your leadership, to really bring in these tools. And there's a number within that first module of Healthy Moms, Happy Babies, there are a number of trauma-informed organizational tools that are there. And I think that you'll find them to be, fairly magic. And nobody has to reinvent the wheel. We found some really good stuff for you to use.
Yeah. I would also encourage folks to visit the National Child Traumatic Stress Network website. I know some folks had asked about sort of graduate programs or other curriculums or training certification programs on trauma-informed care and adverse childhood experiences, and I think the National Child Traumatic Stress Network has a few online programs. Also, we will send out some resources related to that over email, so it's easier to just do the website in email. I have one sort of meaty question that I want to make sure we get to. So given what the presentation today, are you suggesting that we move away from an ACEs screening tool and or adding in universal education, or what's our latest sort of thinking about that?
It's a really good question. It's a fairly controversial question. I love that, Leona. Thanks for doing that to me. I actually would strongly recommend that, Big Future strongly recommends that folks do universal education for all the reasons that you all highlighted, right? So I asked you two really important poll questions. I asked them because I had a good sense of what folks were going to answer. And the first question was, do you think people will answer if they were given a screening tool with, you know, when you were 18 years of age or younger, you know, did this happen to you, did that happen to you? You know, looking at all those areas. So I asked if folks would answer truthfully. And the answer was, well, some, right? Some will, and that has everything to do with trust. And then there were a lot of folks who said, no way, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because they don't trust you, because they're concerned about child welfare. And then I asked if there were potential harms related to parents' ACE scores, and folks said, you know, yeah, I think there's a lot of concern around child welfare. Those are real concerns. And I think when we enter into conversation with families, we create more opportunities for learning. So one of the things that teachers have learned around domestic violence screening, right, and on the one hand, we want people to be asked if they're being hurt in their relationship, but what we really want is a conversation to happen around what you do and don't deserve. And I can give you lots of examples of how screening for domestic violence is being done terribly, right? So if my back is turned to you and I'm looking at a computer screen and I say, so no one's hurting you at home, right? You have no choice but to answer, right. And if I hand you a screening tool about domestic violence, I say, I'm really sorry I have to give this to you. It's a program requirement. My boss makes me do this. So just go ahead and fill it out, and then we can go on to the next thing. Now, in both of these cases, these staff people, who I'm going to assume are well-intentioned, kind, and care, did this because either they were afraid of being triggered themselves, they were afraid of what to do with a yes if she said this was happening to them, and that they didn't feel prepared. And so when we're talking about, I think, complicated psychosocial issues, you know, there are those brilliant providers out there. I think Nadine Burke Harris is one of them. I think Bob Block is another one. I mean, there's a number of sort of folks out there that having these kinds of conversations is easy peasy, as my daughter would say, lemon squeezy. And so, of course, they could have a broader conversation and do a deeper dive. And that mom and that dad is going to feel fine about that conversation. They're going to like that conversation. But when I'm thinking about what's going on in real time in the field and what's my goal here, my goal is to say, oh, my goodness, there's tons of trauma. There's tons of homes, parents who come from homes with adversity, and nobody's ever talked to them about it. Nobody's ever talked to them about how that can affect their parenting. And I think that we have this crazy opportunity with universal education to not wait to provide help. And the same thing is true with domestic violence, right? If I go over a safety card, an education card with every parent, no matter what, I don't need them to disclose. My giving them the key information that they need and the supports they need is not dependent on a score of 4 or a score of 3 or a score of 8. And the same thing is true for domestic violence. Like, you know, if we set it up so that there's a combination of universal education for sure with everyone across the board, and I think about universal education and ACEs like fluoride in the water or immunization, right? We want everyone to have fluoride in the water because we don't want them to have rotten teeth. And I don't need to know if your family has better enamel or worse enamel. I don't need to know that. I just want to put fluoride in the water. And I think that's very much the way we think about the universal education approach Did I answer it?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very similar in terms of the self-regulation, skill building, and all those activities that folks can do in the classroom and Head Starts and you know, clinics that build the capacity of all children.
Yep.
So that when there is someone having a disruptive episode, you know, the other kids have the skills and the wherewithal to support each other. You know, so I think that that is just, you know, really good classroom management to some extent when you are sort of providing both children the skills to be able to handle traumatic experiences and life,
yep,
in addition to providing parents and folks that you work with in your organization the information to be able to support each other and help each other. So to me, that it is like fluoride in the water, and it is really sort of true prevention, and leads us to a clearer path towards really early intervention. So I want to thank you again, Rebecca. We are sort of approaching the end of our time, and I want to make sure that Shondell has an opportunity to close us up. Are there any final thoughts, Rebecca, that you want to add in, or parting words? I want to make sure that you have one last shot.
I just want to acknowledge every single person who dialed in today and is going to share this information with their colleagues in the field. I just want to thank you for the work that you do for families. It makes a huge difference. It's made a huge difference for me as a parent, and I hope to see more conversations around how we can build resiliency and deeper connected parent, connected kids relationships. So thank you again to everyone.
Thanks, Rebecca. I want to turn it over to Shondell for our closing.
Well, thank you, everyone, for making time to join us. I also want to thank Rebecca and Leanna for an incredible presentation. Please know that the Family Violence Prevention and Services Program supports a network of domestic violence services across the country, including domestic violence coalitions, local domestic violence programs, tribal domestic violence programs, as well as national resource centers. Many of you have asked questions about culture-specific resources, both for the Latina community as well as the Asian and Pacific Islander community, and we support 3 culture-specific special issue resource centers. That information will be emailed out to you all. There are also a whole host of resources that are supported, both that look at the wellness of children and supporting abused parents that have been developed by Futures and our Health Resource Center and our National Center on Domestic Violence, Trauma, and Mental Health. We will be certainly willing to share all that information with you all so that we can help you get connected to providers in your local communities as well as stay connected to national resources. Our next webinar will take place on April 29th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. There are 4 webinars that will be in this series. We will be sure to alert everyone who has registered for this webinar about the April 29th webinar. It'll continue our conversation on understanding ways to support parents as well as children that are impacted by domestic violence and keeping you all aware of updated information, research, and tools. I want to thank you all again for joining us. I want to thank our presenters, and this concludes our webinar at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.